It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up later in the program, have you ever wondered what an alfalfa martini or alfalfa ice cream might taste like? Well, me neither, but our guest will make the case for it.
But first, it's wedding season, and that means in many cases the season for excess. Our next guest says many American weddings have evolved into a fixation with material details and resigned acceptance of bridal crusades for perfection. And this trend is starting to spread elsewhere.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. Have you seen this trend in action at any wedding so far this summer? And do you think consumer culture is devaluing the American wedding? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
Hannah Seligson is an author and journalist. Her piece, The Me, Me, Me Wedding, recently ran in Newsweek, and we've got a link to it on our Facebook page. Hannah, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, Hannah, you were married last fall, and leading up to the wedding, what kinds of experiences did you have that sort of got you thinking about this me, me, me bridal culture?
Yeah, well, it was definitely inspired by personal experience. Everyone kept saying, well, it's all about you, which seemed sort of funny to me because the idea of getting married, whether you're marrying another person, that's not all about you. It's about the relationship you're going to build with this other person. And inherent in the wedding process, and I'm sure a lot of your viewers can relate to this too, is, you know, you're trying to deal with a lot of family needs and specifications and trying to accommodate a lot of people. So the kind of messaging, which I think is kind of a brilliant, brilliant ad slogan, as I say in the piece, something that Don Draper or Peggy Olson would have kind of died to come up with, runs counter both to, I think, what marriages need to survive and also what needs to happen to have a wedding planning process where everyone's still speaking and liking each other at the end of it.
Well, when people say this is your day, you know, they're generally talking to the bride, and at least we have to acknowledge that there's a groom there too, at the very least. And you're arguing that we need to expand that circle well beyond just the bride and groom, but to the families and the community.
Right, exactly. And sort of I end with this plea where I say, you know, dance with your mother at your wedding, accommodate whatever, you know, everyone's dietary restrictions are. I'm not saying that I did this perfectly at all, so I don't want to hold myself up as a perfect beacon of accommodation. But that, and I think other cultures, I think there's a sort of an interesting thing going on in other cultures, particularly in India and China. Some of them get the communal stuff much better than we do in the U.S., and it's much more about the family, although there's still a lot of excess in those cultures. But we definitely, you know, as I think I also mentioned in the piece, if we said, hey, this is about your family and your grandparents and your parents, you could practically hear everyone's wallets closing.
Would you have a sense when weddings went from being, you know, probably simple things that happened in a church with the reception in the church basement to these more, you know, materialistic extravaganzas?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of want to pin every cultural watershed moment in the country to the internet. And so I think it became with the proliferation of all these different wedding sites, which can also be very helpful, but have made it into the wedding registry. And now you have, you know, we've even seen the rise in the last couple of years. There's so many wedding boards on Pinterest. It's just become this real, everything has just become a consumer opportunity. And I think that the internet has played a huge role in that.
So the internet, wasn't it happening before that, though? Was it maybe when people started to get a little more secular, you say, maybe?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. And you see that the millennial generation is the least religiously identified generation in America. But I think even with Gen Xers, it wasn't so much the case. And I've even had people who are not that much older in their late 30s and 40s say, well, you know, it wasn't like this when I got married. And I think that, you know, Facebook, and I'll just kind of, again, tie back to the internet, I think social media and Facebook in particular, weddings now become this big competition thing because it's not just the people at your actual, the present at your actual wedding who see it, it's then, you know, your hundreds or thousands of friends or followers on social media. So I think that it kind of ratchets up the pressure.
Now, you said that this kind of wedding is not just, you know, an American thing anymore, that it's gone beyond America. Where else are we seeing this kind of huge wedding?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, in China and India and Brazil, and as we see these kind of these huge developing countries get richer and richer and the explosion of the middle class, we are exporting a lot of our values there. I think I say in the piece that in China, which has more people than the U.S., I mean, the wedding industry has already surpassed the multi-billion-dollar industry here. So, I interviewed one woman who was a wedding planner, a party planner in Brazil, and she says that so many of her clients want to come to the U.S. to buy their dresses, and it's just we've kind of pioneered this obsession with weddings.
Is it partly because it's, you know, a rite of passage? You go from being, you know, your own person to being part of a couple, and maybe it's a last hurrah for selfishness?
Right, and I kind of sort of came to that when I was thinking about what are the reasons. And look, I just want to be clear. I mean, a wedding is a moment to celebrate. And so I had a big party. I'm totally not against having a big party. But I think that there is this idea of, you know, you can kind of go back into the room and it can be all about you before you have to enter a marriage where it's not all about you anymore. And there is something sort of sad about that, that you have to celebrate the end of it being about you. Hopefully you'll be in a marriage or a relationship where you can find some balance there. So I think particularly for women, there's a lot of this messaging about, well, it's your day. I mean, it sounds like you'll never have another day that's just about you ever again. And hopefully that will be true.
Do you have a sense of how guys feel about this? Because it is so focused on the woman and her bridal party and all of the expectations and fashion and, you know, bridesmaids nights out. Does it extend to the guys too?
You know, I think you have seen the rise of the groomzilla. It's not as much, and again, I'll sort of point my finger to the marketing. And I think also it has a negative effect on the couples. I've heard just anecdotally from friends and people I've interviewed as I've reported on this topic who kind of just want to hunker down and wait to re-meet their fiancé after the wedding when they're not so crazy anymore, and they've kind of exited this vortex of selfishness. But I think that you know, and it would be interesting to sort of chart the rise of this trend where we see more kind of men take on groomzilla characteristics.
Well, you do write about, I can't remember the name of the writer, but a fellow who says that he restricted his parents, you know, from doing too much, having too heavy a hand in his wedding. He didn't let them invite any of their friends. And he went on to regret that, and that this is really, you know, an example of what you're talking about here.
Right, exactly. It was John Dickerson who wrote this piece in Slate, where 17 years after his own wedding and where he had kind of drawn the line in the sand and told his parents, you can't invite your friends to your wedding, thinking about his own son's wedding. His own son is 10 years old. So, you know, way down the line, thinking about how he kind of misjudged what a wedding was about and kind of came to many of the same conclusions that I did in my piece, which is that the wedding is a much more communal thing and that he was being petty and that he was kind of wrongheaded to think that this was just about them because it wasn't.
Now, how much do you think this has to do with religion and people having faith? Because when, you know, you were talking about the simpler era of weddings, it seems as though people were often getting married in a church and you were reading those standard vows, at least in America, and people are writing their own vows and people are having friends marry them. How much do you tie this to faith declining?
Yeah, and I don't want to sound like a zealot for everyone having a religious wedding because I think it's highly personal. But I do think that religious ceremonies do sort of temper the kind of individual tendencies in weddings, and that you know, when people start writing their own scripts, it just inevitably becomes all about those two people, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just kind of a shift in how we go about getting married in America.
Well, we're talking with Hannah Seligson about her article, The Me Wedding. She's also the author of the book, Mission Adulthood, How the 20-somethings of Today Are Rewriting the Playbook on Work, Love, and Life. And we want to know what you think. Have you seen this bridezilla culture in action? And do you feel like it's changing the way weddings happen and what they mean? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll be right back with more. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're continuing our conversation with Hannah Seligson about the trend of the me, me, me wedding, where, you know, the brides are told it's all about you. This is your day. And talking about some of the family and the community that might be getting left out in that process. And if that rings a bell with you, maybe you have a regret from your own wedding where you were maybe too selfish and didn't think about the community. Let us know. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. And we go to the phone lines right now. Sally is our first caller from Green Bay. Hi, Sally.
Hi. My husband actually just stood up in a wedding recently. He and I got married 4 years ago now. And but in this wedding, it was kind of weird. They did pictures for like a very long time. They went to three different places to take pictures. And one of the things they actually had the groomsmen and the bridesmaids do was like hold hands or put their arms around each other. And in a lot of cases, the groomsmen and the bridesmaids didn't even know each other. So it was like they were building this fantasy of them all being together or something. It was very strange.
And so that was, you were not at that wedding?
We have a under 1 year old now. So I was briefly at the wedding and then I had to leave.
Okay.
So but it was just very strange.
Yeah, that's interesting, Sally. And Hannah, that strikes me, you know, reminds me of some of the things I've seen on Pinterest where it seems like there are these over-the-top wedding photos are really in style right now. There are boudoir photos that the bride gives to the husband, racy photos of herself, and all these crazy, you know, wedding party photos. What do you think about Sally's experience there?
Yeah, well, so Sally's experience kind of, and I think that she uses the perfect word, this kind of fantasy that when one agrees to be in a wedding party, you're kind of buying into the bride or the groom's fantasy, and you are just a kind of an actor in their play. And, you know, I sort of have a theory that being a bridesmaid is a sort of the last vestige of, like, the mean girl culture where you have to go along with what everyone says. And, it's fine, but it's sort of just an interesting role for adult women to be playing for each other.
All right. Thanks so much, Sally. Appreciate the stories there. And we move to Greg in Oconomowoc. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I worked at a wedding store, and I used to do a lot of decorations for, like, receptions and weddings and everything like that. And for the 5 years I was in, like, the crazy business of weddings, I saw a big shift in my clientele where I had, you know, I was working with moms and daughters and, you know, families coming in and working on the receptions to more currently, I saw much more just brides, maybe a friend, and they would come in with the Pinterest, with the Facebook, with all their ideas and everything. And it went from my parents are giving me, you know, $1,000 to spend on flowers to we don't have a budget. We're just going to spend whatever we want on it. We're not getting a house. We're going to have this wedding.
Really?
And it was just very, very interesting to see that they were like, yeah, we don't really want a car. We don't want a new car. We want, like, this wedding. Like, it was very, very, I mean, for me, like, surreal to see these people spend $40, $30, $50, anywhere in there for, like, the average wedding that I was seeing. And it was just, like, amazing to me to just see, like, how much it changed from the parents being the main support in the wedding to now it was these kids that had these grown-up jobs that were making the money to where they could just spend it. And
wow.
They just did. I don't know. It's funny.
Yeah, what a perspective that is. Hannah, what do you think about that story?
I'm so glad that point was brought up because I think that's kind of the most insidious sort of sad part of the whole wedding culture is people who are so kind of attracted and wheeled in by these messages that they go into debt and that they, you know, say, I'd rather have a wedding than a down payment on a house, than have to go into debt to get a mortgage. And so I think that, you know, you see a lot of these big weddings and sometimes they can't afford them. And you look at, you know, I did a little bit of research, on weddings in other cultures and you see that people in South Korea and India and China and just like in the U.S. go to great lengths to pay for these huge parties. And it's the kind of keeping up with the Joneses that I think can be very bad for the bottom line.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Greg. And let's go to Barbara next. Barbara's with us from Waupaca. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. Well, I found it interesting that you have this topic today because just yesterday I read on some blog, and I don't remember why I read it, but it was a woman who was commenting about the upcoming television nuptials of the bachelor, Sean, whoever he is, and his bride. But what she was saying was, from what she had heard, it sounded like it was really going to be very traditional and they didn't have a lot going on and it would be boring. And she didn't think she would watch. And I thought, well, now, this is an interesting comment that we expect weddings, especially celebrity weddings, or even, I think this trickles down to everybody's wedding, to be these amazing, entertaining events. And it's sort of like Christmas is, you know, what's the reason for the season? It's sort of like weddings. Well, why? What's happening? What is this event really for? You know, is it for entertaining everybody and putting on a show, or isn't it about joining two families together?
Yeah, some interesting thoughts there, Barbara and Hannah. Do we expect, you know, the Cirque du Soleil when we go to weddings now? Maybe nobody wants a simple wedding. We want a little more bada bing with our wedding.
Yeah, it's sort of about your comment is interesting. You know, it just made me think, you know, the first question, I'm guilty of this too, is you don't ask, oh, well, what do you want your marriage to be like? What's the vision of your, you know, we don't ask each other about like the sort of deep fundamental questions about relationships. We ask, oh, well, what kind of band are you going to have? Who's your caterer? You know, all of the questions kind of revolve around the entertainment and what's in it for the guests. As opposed to kind of, you know, well, what's your best marriage advice, or what is your rabbi or priest or whomever going to say at the wedding? And, I totally agree with you.
So does this go back to what you were saying before about the internet and maybe pop culture in general? You know, there's the Bridezilla reality shows too. Do people just expect this now because it's what they see on TV?
Oh yeah, I mean the Kim Kardashian wedding, and I mean just the think about Kate Middleton and Prince William's wedding was a huge event. I mean, people had viewing parties just become, I mean, People Magazine, Us Weekly. I mean, wedding photos, I think, is probably a tie between wedding and baby photos, which I think probably wedding photos edging out has just become a cultural obsession with the wedding, but we're not as obsessed with marriage. You know, the screen kind of goes blank after the wedding.
Well, let's take another phone call now. We've got Rebecca, who's joining us from Trempealeau. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi there.
Hey, what do you think about weddings?
Well, I think it's interesting that, you know, you mentioned the small town, you know, church basement receptions and that kind of wedding. I think it's interesting that it feels like these days people are waiting to make sure they have their education and a stable job, and people aren't taking that leap of faith to go ahead and get married and start their families because they just don't have faith in the economy, or they don't feel like they can make that leap of faith to make that commitment without having that kind of stability.
Right, especially, you know, the economy is difficult now, like you said, Rebecca. And Hannah, does the age of people getting married have something to do with it? They've got more cash, they're waiting longer, and they're going to do more.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, and one that I just wish I had made in the piece, that exactly, that, you know, the median age for first marriage is the highest that it's ever been in U.S. history, both for men and women, and sort of this idea of, well, I've waited, you know, so long into my 20s, some people into their 30s, and I found the right person, I've dated so much, and, you know, gosh darn it, I want to make this into a big celebration because this has been the real culmination of a decade-long search. And so I really think there's a huge correlation between the rising age in marriage and how people made it into a bigger deal, because in some ways it is a bigger deal.
What advice would you give, you know, to people getting married now? You know, based on some lessons you've learned, you just got married, you've been observing this bridezilla culture getting out of hand, running amok, and then being exported to other countries like China and Brazil. It sounds like you're advocating for people to rein it in and ask the important questions. And so I guess my question to you is, what are those important questions and what advice would you give around them?
Yeah, I guess my cardinal piece of advice would be to think about, you know, your parents and your in-laws, not just in the context of the wedding, but these are people you are going to be with and want to be close to, hopefully, for the rest of your life. And that this is, you know, and people have said this, but it is so true, it is just one day. And so, but, I mean, you can leave a lot of hurt feelings over one day. So to think about the kind of consequences of one's actions
surrounding the wedding and use it more of a time to think about how you want to be as a member of your new family. You know, you kind of have the wedding as an opportunity to set the tone. You don't want to look back on it and think, well, that was the time when I was in my bridezilla mode, you know? Mm. You want to think that you were your best self during that period.
Yeah, I suppose you want to use the wedding to bring you and your fiance, your new husband, closer together into your community.
Exactly. I couldn't have said it better.
Well, Hannah, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
That was author and journalist Hannah Seligson. She's the author of the book Mission Adulthood, How the 20-somethings of Today Are Rewriting the Playbook on Work, Love, and Life. And we've got a link to her article, The Me, Me, Me Wedding, on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about the 50th anniversary of the South African police raid that revealed Nelson Mandela's journals and papers and propelled his story beyond South Africa.
But first, we're going to talk about a quirky dinner happening next week in Hilbert, Wisconsin, in the middle of a cornfield. It's the second annual alfalfa dinner at Village Hearthstone Restaurant.
Now, alfalfa, of course, is a quintessential food here in Wisconsin, but it's usually cows that are doing the eating. Joining us now is Village Hearthstone General Manager and Head Chef Tracy Darling, who thinks that people should give alfalfa a try, too. Tracy, welcome to Central Time. Now, for the uninitiated, I know that there are a lot of farm kids in the audience, but for the uninitiated, what exactly is alfalfa?
Well, it's the hay that cows eat, and it's a very strong, hardy plant that has a good root system, and it grows very abundantly and well in Wisconsin, and it's the main component of cows' diets and among the other things that they do eat, and makes for great-tasting milk and cheese.
And so, for the people in the audience who have not tasted alfalfa in its natural state, is there a way that you can describe it?
I would say if you tasted wheatgrass,
mm-hmm.
It has some of the properties of wheatgrass, but it's more fragrant and floral, and it is also a member of the same plant family as sweet peas. So there's some element of that sort of flavor in it, too. And it's very delicious, herbaceous. And very tasting of green, you know, it has a chlorophyll almost flavor in a very pleasant way.
So you're sitting there at the Village Hearthstone a year and a half or 2 years ago, before the first annual alfalfa dinner. What inspired you to even start down this path?
Well, you know, the farm-to-table trend is very much a part of the way people in this part of the state have always lived, and we didn't necessarily call it that, but we just grew our own vegetables and we milked cows and butchered them for meat, and the flavor and the freshness of those foods I think are what people aspire to today. So I was looking for something that would maybe get people's attention and would be a fun celebration of this focus on really fresh, locally raised food. And because Village Hearthstone is really literally, as is Hilbert, in the middle of cornfields and hayfields and all of that, I thought alfalfa might be a nice place to start. So we put a dinner together where every course had alfalfa in it in some way. And that meant that we would either juice the leaves, or I'd make an oil out of the leaves to marinate chicken in, for instance, or we would soak it in cream to make ice cream. And we managed to develop a menu that reflected alfalfa in a lot of different ways, from sweet to savory, and put it together with some other fun things happening throughout the dinner, and it was quite a hit.
So before we get to the spectacularly good dishes that you had, did you have any spectacular failures when you were trying to figure out some recipes?
You know, I've been cooking strangely for a long time. And we fortunately we had good success with alfalfa, and I knew I was so familiar with it because I grew up on a farm myself and had spent a lot of time baling hay and feeding it to cows. I had sort of a sense of how far you could go with it. And, you know, we do start the meal off slowly for the uninitiated or for those who haven't actually eaten alfalfa before. And we'll start off with alfalfa sprouts in the first course just to kind of get people used to the flavor and to use something that they probably have tasted before or, you know, have seen in the grocery store. And then as the meal progresses, we use it a little more strongly in a little different ways. So once that flavor is familiar to people, they can appreciate the different ways that you can taste it with different ingredients.
So last year, this is the second annual dinner. So the first one was a smashing success, I take it?
Yes. We don't have a huge dining room, but it was full.
Full is good. So the second annual alfalfa dinner, what's on the menu?
Well, this year we're starting with a little amuse-bouche, which is a skewer of local fresh mozzarella and some oven roast tomato, alfalfa sprouts, and we're serving it in a braised peanut pesto because peanuts, like alfalfa and soybeans, are part of the legume family, and they share some of the same flavor profiles. So we're going to cook the peanuts, and they're a nice complementary flavor to the alfalfa sprouts. And then we'll move on to an alfalfa panna cotta, which is like an eggless custard, but it's savory, and that's served with a scallop cruda and cucumber and pea shoot salad. Again, all the flavors kind of matching each other. And then we relieve all of that with a mini alfalfa martini, and that is something that we're getting known for. And we do make them throughout the years for as long as we've got fresh alfalfa available to us to do it. And that is served with a cold smoked bluegill crostini and some pickled asparagus that we just are making. After that, we've got some alfalfa butter tossed with hand-cut pasta and some house-smoked ham and local shelled sugar peas. And then we're having an alfalfa-cured pork schnitzel, where I juice the alfalfa and soak the pork in that along with some other flavorings and create a schnitzel out of it. And we're doing that with wild rice crepes and a maple balsamic butter and cream spinach. And we're ending the dinner with a pistachio torte that's filled with an alfalfa honey mousse and covered in chocolate. So I think if you get to the end of the meal, you will have a good sense of what alfalfa is all about.
Now, I imagine the audience for this are people who are sophisticated about food. And having said that, are they surprised at the end of it all, at the end of the first one of these that you have? I mean, did you have people literally say something along the lines of, I didn't think alfalfa could taste like that?
Yes, I think we heard that echoed throughout the dining room. And, you know, it isn't something that people consider eating themselves. But if you've ever lain in a field of alfalfa or been near a freshly cut hay field, the scent's very appealing, and it feels very fresh and healthy. And it's widely used as a supplement, or people make smoothies with alfalfa powder and, you know, that sort of thing. So even with that, most people haven't actually tasted it fresh. So it is quite a sensation that first time out for most people. I think it's the alfalfa martini that really is the experience that people remember.
I'll bet it is, or not, depending on how many
or
martinis
not.
They have.
That's right.
So let me ask a very practical question. So let's say I'm out driving along County Trunk P or whatever it is, and I spot a field of alfalfa, and it looks just like plain old alfalfa that the cows are going to eat in the winter and be baled. Is that alfalfa? I could just stop by the side of the road and pick that, and it would work?
Well, presuming the farmer didn't come out with his rifle.
Right.
And
always
find you there, but
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, I mean, we're using organic alfalfa that my dad cuts with a weed whacker because he's got a farm near here and access to all of that. But that is the alfalfa that we're using. Yep.
Do you ever run into people who are skeptical about it? I'm thinking of some of the farm kids I used to know when I went to school, and I just have a hard time believing. They would look at me a little crossways and say, "You're going to eat what?"
Yeah, there's a little bit of that even among the people who, you know, who work with it. Perhaps more among the people who are more familiar with it. But once we get a spoonful of something into someone's mouth, they usually are converted. And because we only do it once a year, I think it's a great opportunity to try something that's such a big part of our agricultural culture in the state, but usually reserved for animals, of course.
And if you've got a second or two, could you share a quick recipe with us? Something people could try at home that's easy that might get them started?
Sure, you bet. It's pretty easy to make ice cream in general. And if you do have access to fresh alfalfa, we make our ice cream with it by simply soaking the leaves in cream and sugar, and we add a little fresh mint to that also. So the any normal ice cream recipe that you would use, you simply flavor the cream part of it with fresh alfalfa leaves, simmer it on the stove very gently and quietly for 20 minutes to half an hour, and then cool it down and make ice cream the way that you normally make it. You can also use it to make whipped cream by simply soaking it in cold cream as well and letting that just be the flavor that you give the cream when you whip it.
All right. Well, that sounds, actually, it sounds pretty tasty. Tracy, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having us.
That was Tracy Darling. Obviously, she's got some other things going on. People calling to get in on the alfalfa dinner, I imagine. She is the general manager and head chef of Village Hearthstone in Hilbert. And for a copy of the recipe we just talked about, you can check out the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
50 years ago today, the South African police raided a small farmhouse outside of Johannesburg in what's known as the Raid on Lily's Leaf. The house was the center of activists working to end apartheid in South Africa.
In the raid, police found journals and papers of Nelson Mandela's detailing his work against the South African government and his thoughts on using violence against apartheid.
The government used these papers to sentence Mandela to a life in prison. The activists used the trial as a platform for their beliefs. And here to talk about this moment in history with us is Edmund Keller, a research professor of political science and the former director of UCLA's James S. Coleman African Studies Center. Edmund, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Well, let's start with the Lily's Leaf raid. What happened that day?
Well, it was at a time when the ANC was under intense pressure from the apartheid government. Mandela had been arrested along with over 100 other activists fighting apartheid. But some of the supporters who were connected with the Spear of the Nation, the militant wing of the ANC, had been using this place at Lily's Leaf, a farm, as a communication site and also a meeting place. And they were in the process of meeting when they were raided by the South African police. The importance about that particular site at the time was that Mandela, after his arrest, had told his comrades that they should destroy all the papers that he was compiling relating to the possible armed struggle against the South African government. They, instead of doing that, tried to hide the papers away. However, they were discovered by the South African government. And Mandela, of course, felt that if it was found out what he was really up to, he could very well be sentenced to death. But fortunately, he wasn't. But the papers were taken by the government. And right now, they made available to the public as a sort of a testimony to the struggle and to the humanitarian principles of the ANC.
Well, let's talk about those papers. So Mandela had asked some lawyers, those close to him, to destroy these papers. Somehow they didn't get destroyed. I'm not sure why, but what was in them that was so significant?
Well, he was talking about the possibility of nonviolence wasn't working for the ANC anymore. The activists were very upset that they had intended to engage in some sabotage, urban guerrilla warfare and things of that nature. And that didn't seem to be going too well, but there was a plan for armed struggle. And that's what was so significant about those papers.
When the police raided Lily's Leaf, did they have an inkling that they were going to find evidence against Mandela there, or was that just dumb luck?
Oh, yeah, they had been tipped off, that the activists had been using this place. Also, what they were doing there was they had a radio station that they would periodically, unpredictably use to transmit the Freedom Charter message to the those who could get access to that radio station. But they would often sort of, they would always actually stop transmitting too soon for the South African government to discover where they were. But apparently by this time they had found out that this is where the hub of the ANC was at this particular time.
Now, the finding of these papers would seem to be a blow to the anti-apartheid movement, a blow to Mandela. Apparently he could have been hanged for the evidence in those papers. But it didn't unfold quite that way, did it?
Well, it did, in fact. It was a very serious blow. There were periods in South African history where there were blows delivered to the anti-apartheid movement. In 1961, there was the Sharpeville massacre, which was, sort of the state coming down hard on anti-apartheid activists. In 63, Mandela was sentenced at this Rivonia trial along with a lot of the people that were sort of a part of this militant wing of the ANC. And he went to jail, of course, for almost 30 years. There was, for a time from that point on, where the freedom movement went underground. Politics for black people were banned. There was heavy pressure put on non-black activists who were against the apartheid regime, and it was a pretty dark time. And in fact, things didn't begin to change until the black consciousness movement emerged in the 70s. But again, the South African government came down hard on that movement, killing one of its prominent leaders, Steve Biko. And, there was periodic uprisings, but for all intents and purposes, between 63, or I should say from the time of the Sharpeville massacre, the only black politics that was taking place in South Africa was underground all the way up until the late 80s when the government began to loosen restrictions on black political activism and participation.
So it's been a long road for sure, and still some people call this raid the spark that ended the spark that started the fire that ended apartheid. Why is that?
Well, because it really raised the apartheid, the excesses of apartheid to an international level as never before. The Rivonia trial was and Mandela addressing the court in some of his very eloquent remarks about the importance of freedom for him and the rest of the oppressed people of South Africa resonated throughout the world. There began to be an inkling of white anti-apartheid movement that demonstrated peacefully for a good number of years after that. But also there emerged a sensitivity in the international community that something needed to be done to bring down apartheid. For example, the divestment movement got its start in the early 1970s when activists were opposed to South Africa's connection with the Gulf Oil Company and also companies like the Kodak film operation was also used by the South African government to help document the identification of those that held under surveillance and so forth and so on. So there were movements against those companies. And then, of course, the seeds for the divestment movement grew out of that and also the consciousness in the world community about what was going on in South Africa arose. You have to remember, when Ronald Reagan came into office in the U.S., what he was pushing for was constructive engagement with South Africa. And, of course, when you do that, you lay the groundwork for opposition to that as well. So here in the U.S., there was sort of a sides taking around that time. And, of course, in South Africa, too, even though the politics was banned, there was political activity, violence in townships against those who collaborated with the government. So it sparked sort of the beginning of various efforts of protest inside and outside the country.
Now, I've only got about 20 seconds left, but with Mandela lying ill in the hospital, does Lily's Leaf raid, does that mean more in South Africa today?
Well, it does in a way, because, you know, there's so many other things that people have been thinking about that history of apartheid, that that particular site has not been talked about much. But, you know, I would suspect that in the next few days, months, I should say, people will begin to appreciate the significance of that that particular raid, particularly since there was a museum which has been constructed at that very site, shows, you know, the housing units where Mandela and his supporters lived during that time.
And, Edmund, I'm sorry, we have to leave it there. We're out of time. But thank you so much for speaking with us today.
You're quite welcome.
That was Edmund Keller, professor of political science and former director of UCLA's Coleman Center for African Studies.